Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. You're here with Tim, Charlie, Andy, and Josh. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast.
Good afternoon, men.
Hey. how's it going?
Josh, tell me what's going on in English land. It going down there?
It's going well. We, in the British Lit class that I'm teaching, just started Middlemarch.
Yeah.
By George Eliot or Marianne Evans. And it's going well. It's going to be a challenge because we're reading basically 100 pages a day as we finish it, because it's an 800-page novel and we can't take forever on it. But
yeah,
the students are responding well to it thus far. It fits in with a conversation that you have ignited in our student body in a counseling adolescence class.
About?
Just about these authors and their influence on the way that we think of marriage and love.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah.
So. And Marianne Evans actually lived most of her life in an open relationship with a man that couldn't divorce his wife.
Yeah.
It's so
interesting how we're just a couple degrees removed. Like, most of our reception of some of these works are, like, the modern adaptations of them, or, like, modern perception of them. So, like, why is Pride and Prejudice such a big thing in Christian circles? Because the movie and the book are decently clean because it's set in an English culture, but nestled into the weeds of that is proto-feminism. And you don't even know, like, you're like, oh, I love that. And it's just, anyway. But I've been told that I would like Middlemarch.
I think so.
Okay. I was going to say, I would trust your judgment more. And so you think it too. So,
yeah,
okay.
One of the first comments students made is how much they were engaged by the narrator.
Hmm.
Because the narrator is depicting the culture, but also kind of poking fun at certain people in certain circumstances. It's very similar to what a Jane Austen does at times. But
all right, so if Josh is in English land, that means Andy's in apologetics land.
Yes, apologetics land.
Everything good in apologetics land?
Yeah, it's going well. Today, actually, this is like very, very exciting. So today is the day can I talk about Western Civ, actually? The two are back to back.
How's everything going in Western Civ land?
Thank you so much, Charlie. Today is the day we talk about pre-modern, modern, and post-modern.
Ooh.
And so I lay it out. I had three students volunteer to be the stick men, and I would like draw horrible drawings of them. And it was super helpful. And it was on my screen when I got to Greek. And Morelli Fritz was like, hey, yeah, you were doing that today, but like, you did that in the podcast like 3 years ago, and as you were talking about it today, I'm like, we already heard this. So she literally listened to the Bowder episode 3 years ago. So I was like, hey, look at that. That was so good. And she remembered it 3 years later. But
storing up wisdom.
That's right. But I think that is such a helpful dynamic. So that's one of my favorite lectures of the year.
Not to be forgotten. How's everything in patriarchal Old Testament land?
What a world is that?
I really thought he was going to say Hebrew, but that was much better, Charlie.
I've been working on my regional ETS paper, which I present 1 week from Saturday. I think I have like 3 pages and a terrible outline that I had and then trashed, and now I need to rework my outline. So it's going to be a bit of a dumpster fire, probably, of a presentation, but it'll be okay. We'll talk about it. It might be more of a talk as opposed to a paper presentation.
How long typically are papers in your academic conferences?
20 minutes.
20 minutes, yeah.
Yeah. So I'll be able to do like an introduction, an explanation of where I want to go, and then some information about the discussion, and then I'm probably just going to pull the Bible up on the screen and then talk to them about it and see if they have any questions. So that's the current plan. I've been told, I've gone to some presentations where they just talk the whole way through. It's not actually like a paper presentation. I don't want to do that. I want to have something to actually.
And remind us the title, working title.
I'm already changing my title, which is another part of the party.
We should guess.
Yeah. What's my title?
Wait.
Well, give us the first title, and then we'll try to recreate the new title.
Or tell us about the paper in like 2 sentences.
It's about Song of Songs. 2 seconds. It's about Song of Songs, chapter 3, verses 6 through 11. And you have the phrase repeated, who is this coming up from the wilderness? The phrase is in Song 3, 6 and in Song 8, 5. And they're like, couldn't find much literature written about it, but now I found like 4 or 5 sources that actually discuss it specifically. And they're even noticing the phrase, who is this, occurs in Song 6, 10. So what is the purpose of this refrain? Is it even a refrain? But what is the purpose of this refrain? Why is it a question? Nobody's dealing with the rhetorical question, the nature of it being a rhetorical question. And then the nature of Song 3, 6 through 11 is the Solomonic marriage. So this woman's coming out of the wilderness. I would say it's the woman. Some say that it's the carriage and it's potentially carrying Solomon. That's wrong. It's the woman coming out of the wilderness and she's in the carriage. She has the armed guard and there's massive scents and aromas that are accompanying her. And then the wedding's in verse 11. So that's what my paper is about, is that refrain.
All right, gentlemen, let's give him a title.
I'll pull up my paper because I don't even remember. Who dat? You're horrendous.
Who dat? When the sensi lady comes to town.
Ooh, it's not bad. That's not bad.
I wanted to work the wilderness in there somehow.
Oh, yeah.
Who dat sensi lady coming out the wilderness?
That's a cop out.
Let's see here. You know, when the man comes around, when the woman comes around.
So there's multiple ways to do education. I think the best way would be to focus on the right things. Like, this is the way to do it. You can conversely learn by seeing what the wrong options are and avoiding them.
That's a good point.
And I think that's what we're doing right now.
Okay. And that's also the point of my paper.
Last one.
No, you're like close to the idea of my paper.
Oh.
And he didn't even realize it.
When the church comes to meet up with Christ.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Actually, the allegorical interpretation comes to this text a lot.
Charlie's brain just glitched, and he couldn't say anything for like 2 seconds.
It is
kind of
funny that we did go around the circle with that, and it did take a second rotation to get to allegorically interpreting the song.
Okay, so
what is it, Tim? What's your title?
So my title that I submitted was The Female Lover and Her Foil. The 4 primary characters of the Song of Songs.
Like tinfoil?
Foil, like...
I literally was thinking tinfoil.
Guys, she's a type. So the female lover and her foil.
Yes.
The foil of the female lover would
be... The opposite.
The opposite of.
It keeps her fresh.
Yeah.
And then I've changed the title. So I submitted a proposal to the Society of Biblical Literature, along the same lines, by the way, but I changed the title because after researching, I modified... The Female Lover's Foil, Harem Girl as the 4th primary character in the Song of Songs. So I believe
that... Harem Girl.
Harem Girl. Song 3, 6 through 11 is a description of Solomon's bride, the Harem Girl. And several commentators have noticed in Song 3, 6 through 11 how the text is very negative. It's portraying the wedding negatively. And they've hit on several things that I didn't even see. And so that actually furthers my case. That the wedding in Song 3, 6 through 11 is paradigmatic of a royal wedding, and this is not God's ideal.
Well played. Well played.
Good luck following that, Josh.
All right. I think it's time. Is there anything else before, Tim?
Books and business.
All right. Let's talk about some books.
That's so funny. I thought we were in books and business already. My bad. All right, so
that would substitute for books in business.
Well, I thought maybe he's reading books on tinfoil or something. So I am busy. So I'm working on a number of projects and creative things.
Hi, busy.
Hi, nice to meet you, man. That's like what I say to Abby all the time.
I'm sorry.
Hey,
let me. Can I ask Tim a dad joke?
Oh yeah.
Episode again?
No, you're absolutely not allowed to.
Okay, Tim. What's orange and sounds like a parrot?
I am so bad at dad.
Just try, Tim. You can get this.
Orange and sounds like a parrot?
Yeah.
Toucan.
No.
There we go.
A carrot.
Look, he knew it.
Do you get it? Because a carrot
I got it. Similar
to a parrot.
I usually do need him to explain the jokes for me, but I got that one.
Okay, so you're busy.
Why don't pirates take a shower before they walk the plank? Because they just wash up on shore. I'm really busy working on creative stuff, so I haven't read a lot, but I have been listening to more Lulamore books because that's the kick I'm on. And so I just listened to the fourth one called Jubal Sackett. And these are just fun stories. They're very, very interesting. And not really much questionable. In this one, there was a statement, though, where this person, he's kind of like a frontiersman, and he meets this Native American gal. And, of course, there's some stuff going on where they are going to end up getting married, as you can guess. But when he marries her, he has to give her the fire from the sun. And so he has this little prism, and he's going to, like, pretend to have magic and light leaves on fire with the prism so he can have this, like, ever-burning fire that she had back in her village. And he says, everyone thinks different things about religion, and who am I to judge theirs? They may just be as right as I am, and I have decided to respect all religions. What would it harm if I did this thing that meant something to her, and then she could be in my family? And so he does this, like, what he thinks will appease her, and it does. And when he made that statement, I had just recently read about the books, and they said there's a lot of social Darwin, or there's some social Darwinism in there. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. Up to this point, there's been almost nothing religious except for references to Christianity that seem kind of cultural. And it was just one statement, so I wouldn't invalidate the book. But I was like, oh, that was interesting. That's like about the spiciest thing I've gotten. But fun little stories. I'd probably recommend it. I don't think I'd rank it. It's not like bad or anything, but just kind of fun little things to read on the way. I have to say, the part of me that loves going west and going to the mountains loves it. I think you would enjoy it, Charlie. All the like elk hunts you've been on and all that. I think you'd enjoy these.
Too bad. I'm reading Middlemarch.
Well, I thought Feminism. I thought that was about the Ides of March when it first came up. I'm like, who's getting stabbed? So that's my books and business.
What was the name of that again? Jubal.
Jubal, J-U-B-A-L. And then the last name is Sackett, S-A-C-K-E-T-T. And it's the story of the Sackett family, and Jubal is the like third son. So it takes place in the 1600s. That's why the names sound old.
So we've done enough random things on this episode. Would we, if we were ranking cultures, would a pagan culture with a non-Christian religious system rank higher than a culture that has no religious system because they have some form of worship in their leisure? Like, would we, you can't have Christian culture. That's not an option. You have to choose pagan religious system or no religious system. We would say that the culture with a religious system would probably rank better.
So it's interesting. I don't think there's any examples of a culture with no religious system.
That's where I was going with it.
There's absolutely none. And the people who have left to be non-religious end up being way more wicked in some ways.
Well, so right. I would agree with you that practically there's no like non-worship. Theoretical. Like people are worshiping. But in a formal sense, like a culture that doesn't have it.
Hmm.
This is interesting. This came up this morning, actually, in our discussion of the Odyssey.
I'm just blossoming into my humanity with these questions.
But a student asked that, you know, this is aesthetically pleasing, but how do I work through this text that has a polytheistic framework? And so I reminded that, or I mentioned to that student and to the class, that distinction, you know, what is this pagan culture that we're seeing in the Odyssey, would it be better or worse than the culture that you currently see in Europe?
Yeah.
Or in our own country in a lot of ways, that has no regard for any gods or beings that exist outside of them, that demand certain things of them.
Like, in a real sense, like, the humans are the gods, like, they've replaced it.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say is better is, you need, I would say, give, like, what do you mean by better? And because better is a judgment word, and it's saying there's some sort of a way it is and another way that it is, and one of those has, is it an advantage or moral goodness? That'd probably be like, I would rather live in a post-Christendom era that still has some leftovers of Christianity than to live in a like an Islamic place where I'm the Christian, because I mean that culture is going to be really hard to live in.
Sure.
So I guess it would kind of depend.
I guess I'm kind of thinking like, well, I don't know what I'm thinking. We'll come back to it. We'll get to
it's almost
more
like
leisure
you've had a,
questions.
It's almost like you've had a bubbler this afternoon.
That is definitely not the case.
So this is just you being bright and bouncy.
Tim, I will rectify my ills here by being very quick with my B&B. I'm reading a book called This Is Happiness, a novel by Niall Williams. It was on Close Reads list, and I'm reading it.
Sounds like a book.
It has a very pretty cover.
It looks a little thick, too.
It does look really pretty.
Honestly, after I read the first chapter, I thought, man, this is going to be too long. But, you know, we'll see. It's not bad, but I wasn't like, oh, goody. Look how long this book is after the first chapter. So
I finished reading The Ball and the Cross by G.K. Chesterton.
Not The Ball and the Chain.
Nope.
Which AI mistakenly thought you were talking about episodes ago.
Yeah, you know. Anyway. So the story of The Ball and the Cross is you have these two guys, this pugnacious atheist and then a monk, a Catholic monk. And the pugnacious atheist, he puts some profanities about the Virgin Mary on the wall of his shop. And the monk sees it and smashes the guy's window. And then they stand before court. And the pugnacious atheist knows what to say to get him out of there. But then they want to do a duel to the death. And they attempt to have their duel on various and sundry locations and places, but they're constantly thwarted. There's a lot of symbolism in the book, and I'll be honest with you, I think a lot of it just went over my head. You know, I'm not very good at getting puns or dad jokes, and so I'm not very good at reading Chesterton. At one point, they're having a duel at the sea, and the pugnacious atheist is about to skewer the monk, and then a wave rolls in and topples him over, and then the monk has to go out and save him from drowning. And I'm like, is he doing something there? You know, it just makes me wonder. Like, is God the paradigmatic wave that wipes him out so then he can't be skewer the guy and then the monk's got to go save him out to sea? So they do a whole pile of different things, and the society is against them and does not want them to fight. And so eventually they're getting cornered, and then they're like, oh, here's a fence, let's just jump over the fence. And they jump over the fence, and they happen to jump straight into a madhouse. It's a garden for mad people, which was the trick. So now the society's actually captured them. So the story seems to be very much like against science. In fact, I think you guys would love this because you love That Hideous Strength and talk mm-hmm. about it all the time. Mm-hmm. It felt very much in the vein of That Hideous Strength. Mm-hmm.
Is that a title of a book?
So in the book later on, there's this one girl, and she like helps them escape. And there's a few people that help them escape, even incidentally, and they aren't really in favor. But then at the end of the book, they bring all of the people that assisted them or even knew them in some way into the insane asylum, and they're like gonna prosecute all of them. And they basically labeled them all mad. So for example, the one girl, there's a funny interchange. I'm not gonna take the time to read through it. I'll talk about the one guy though. The one guy, Mr. Wilkinson, he's basically drunk, and they're being chased by the police, and he's like, you can take my yacht. And so they do. They just kind of steal the guy's yacht and they crash it on an island or an isthmus. And then they drink all of the ale and live it up for a little while. But anyway, Mr. Wilkinson, this guy, there's a little interchange here, and I'm going to read through this. He keeps on telling this is a psychiatrist. A psychiatrist is in the madhouse, and he's talking about Mr. Wilkinson and why Mr. Wilkinson is there. He keeps on telling everybody, and the doctor lowered his voice confidentially. He tells everybody that two people have taken his yacht. His account of how he lost it is quite incoherent. Turnbull, that's the pugnacious atheist, Turnbull stamped his foot on the gravel path and called out, oh, I can't stand this, really? I know, said the psychologist mournfully. It is a most melancholy case, and also, fortunately, a very rare one. It is so rare, in fact, that in one classification of these maladies, it is entered under a heading by itself, perdinavititis. Okay, so basically, you can see navitita, the boat word, and I don't know what the perdi whatever is, but they've created a word.
It's like a play on perdition?
I don't think so, but okay. Then they say a mental inflammation creating the impression that one has lost a ship. So they create a disease and say the guy's mentally insane. Really? And he added with a kind of half-embarrassed guilt, "It's rather a feather in my cap. I discovered the only existing case of perdinavititas." "But this won't do, doctor," said Turnbull, almost tearing his hair. "This really won't do. The man really did lose a ship. Indeed, not to put too fine a point on it, I took his ship." Because they stole the ship. Dr. Quayle swung round for an instant so that his silk-lined overcoat rustled and stared singularly at Turnbull. Then he said with hurried amiability, "Why, of course you did. Quite so, quite so." And with courteous gestures went striding up the garden path. Under the first tree he stooped, however, and pulling out his pencil and notebook, wrote down feverishly, "Singular development in the eleutheromaniac Turnbull. Sudden manifestation of rapinavititas, the delusion that one has stolen a ship. First case ever recorded." So I think he's slamming science massively, like in the progressive world. And then the psychologists are creating various and sundry diseases and then putting people in. And so Chesterton is interacting and poking back at the scientific revolution in its grandiose classifications.
That is beautiful. It reminds me of the DSMV, whatever iteration it's in.
Oh, yeah. You just keep creating more terms of diseases and stuff.
Well, I have a poem, but I'm not going to read the whole poem. I'm just going to read a part of it. It's titled Ulysses. Who is Ulysses? Well, he is Odysseus. It's the Roman name for Odysseus. And this is a poem by Tennyson, Alfred Lord Tennyson. And I mentioned in the past, I know in various episodes, that Homer depicts Odysseus as wanting to get home. That's his objective. He desires to be back in Ithaca. And I said in subsequent literature, that perspective shifts a little bit and people begin to depict Odysseus as not really being all that satisfied with being home. And that's what Tennyson does here in Ulysses. So I'm going to read the first few lines and then I'll read the point where Ulysses is trying to rouse his men to go back out adventuring. Here are the first few lines of the poem Ulysses. "It little profits that an idle king, by this still hearth among these barren crags, matched with an aged wife, I meet and dole unequal laws unto a savage race that hoard and sleep and feed and know not me." So you can get the sense there of a very dissatisfied king in his kingly duties, and everything is barren, and his aged wife and his subjects are frustrating. So about middle way through the poem, he is going to rouse his men and says, we're old, but let's go sailing. And this is just beautiful poetry, and it's very rousing lines, so forgive me if I yell at the end. I won't do that, but I...
Oh, we would like you to.
Anyway, "There lies the port, the vessel puffs her sail. There gloom the dark broad seas. My mariners, souls that have toiled and wrought and thought with me, you and I are old. Old age hath yet his honor and his toil. Death closes all, but something ere the end, some work of noble note may yet be done, not unbecoming men that strove with gods. The light begin to twinkle from the rocks. The long day wanes. The slow moon climbs. The deep moans round with many voices. Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off, and sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows. For my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be we shall touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles, whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides, and though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield." So he's trying to persuade his men to go out and adventure. And of course, the poem might not be a wise poem, but it is a rousing poem.
It was very motivational. It felt like a motivational speaker there. But like a good one, not like a one at your high school or something. So, way to go, Ulysses. And on that note, let's have a conversation about a topic or a term known called irreducible complexity. So I teach the apologetics class here at Faith, one of them, the normal general one everybody takes. There's some other apologetic classes you can take. And in this class, we go through a number of elements, apologetics, different topics, ways to think about it. It's a pretty broad class. But one thing we had that had come up during our discussion of arguments that are demonstrating the reality of God's existence is one known as irreducible complexity, and I thought it was so interesting. I talked about it for years that I thought it might be something fun to talk about on air. Now, to understand how irreducible complexity works, we've got to set a background or set the table, and to do that, I've got to give you a very overview-ish overview of the theory of evolution. So, before we start, if one of you guys had to say, this is what evolution is as it is taught today in public school, what would you say? Could you give me like a one-line description? Anybody? I'm hitting them cold, listeners, so.
The natural processes which caused life to arise or evolve.
Okay, very good. What else?
Well, you would have random chance mutation.
Yep.
And of those mutations, there are some that are more fit than others. And those are the ones that over millions and billions of years, the stronger ones procreate. And eventually that's where you get spanning of species. It's not.
Okay.
It's starting very with good. Very little life and then evolving through the random chance mutations. It's survival of the fittest.
Okay.
In addition to that, I would just say continual improvement or increasing complexity.
Yes.
Shh, don't say that, Josh.
Yes. Charlie, you had mentioned mutations. Can you, for a listener who doesn't know what a mutation is and has only seen the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and knows
I was going to say, it's like you spill some ooze on a turtle and it becomes a human turtle. That would be a mutation.
That's right.
But not really at all, though. It's an error. It's something genetically happens that's random. It's mm-hmm. it's not the normal.
Yeah.
And that mutation that happened. So like, the normal thing was to have two arms, but then someone was born with three arms.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't you know, three arms makes them more fit to survive. And so then eventually everyone has three arms.
Yes.
And we think that might be a absurd example, but that's exactly what is being taught. Like, we started as a single cell, and then it became multiple cells with no arms, mind you. And then eventually here we are with arms, thumbs, all the good things.
Yep. So that's right. And for that to happen, to grow like a whole new arm, you would have to look at the blueprints of the human body, and the blueprints exist in what's known as DNA. DNA is like a very long code that tells your body how to build every single part of it. They have taken the DNA code and they've said, like, if you were to line it up, if it were to be 1 inch wide and like a little piece of paper, it would be something, it's something crazy, like 6 million feet long. I can't remember the figures, but it's an incredible amount of data. So when you look at these things as a Christian, there's lots of ways to poke holes in this theory being workable. But one way to do it is to think through what it would look like for mutations to take place in a way that's positive. So to illustrate mutations, before I get into the background part of this, if you know anything about computer coding is written at like a very base level with just zeros and ones. And I think you have 8 zeros and ones in a row, and that makes a byte or a bit. This has been a long time since I've studied this. But let's say the codes are all like 000111, and then the next one is 00100111. And there's a whole bunch of code like that. But then as I copy it over as the computer, when I magnetically change that part of the hard drive, I accidentally write a 1 when there should be a 0. When that happens to our computers or our smartphones, what do we call that, and what functionally takes place to our devices?
They don't work.
Yeah, and we call it like a bug. Mm-hmm. Okay, our phone, we got a bug. There's a glitch. There's some sort of a problem. I've got to do an update to fix some bugs. And when we say a bug, what we mean is a line of code either ceased operating properly or perhaps it got written wrongly. And this goes back to all kinds of things. In fact, it's kind of similar to textual criticism. When you think about a scribe copying by hand a page out of some book and they write the wrong word. That's kind of the idea. A mutation is one of those code elements in the DNA being wrong. And so here's how evolution works. It's arguing that way back in time, you had simplicity. You had like a one single cell organism that somehow got on the scene. And then given enough time and enough chance, as that thing reduplicates itself, when it copies itself to a new being, reproduces whatever, there's a error in the code, and we're calling that a mutation. But what happens is after it reproduces and reduplicates so many times and stacks enough of those errors, accidentally they line up to create a whole new feature in that thing. So evolution's arguing that if you have enough time and you have enough chance, statistical odds, you can go from something that's utterly simple to something that's vastly complex like our human bodies today. And all of it happens through the mechanism of gene mutation or genetic mutation. That's essentially an overview of the theory of evolution. Now, there is, of course, adaption happening, so survival of the fittest. I'm not denying that. But evolution can sort of get by without that. It has to have the genetic mutation. That's like the key cornerstone. So a consideration at the beginning here is that when evolution argues it can happen accidentally through time and chance, a fundamental bedrock presupposition or assumption is that there cannot be any direction to the process. It has to be undirected. When Darwin was coming up with this theory, he had gone through great suffering and sorrow in his life. And he said in a letter, he said, "I know this sounds fanciful. I know everything appears to be designed, but I have to find a theory that accounts for this without there being a creator." He was really mad at God. So he tried to come up with a system that could explain everything that looks so clearly designed, but didn't need a creator. So the fundamental element of this, like a bedrock conclusion, is there can't be any intelligence behind the process. It just has to be happening at random. A second assumption is that even though undirected time and chance shouldn't be able to produce this, if we could increase the amount of time, the assumption is we increase our odds or the chance in equal measure. Now, I would argue that that's not correct. All right. Now, many people have come up with ways to look at the theory of evolution and show that it should not be able to work. One of those is a guy by the name of Michael Behe. Michael Behe is a biologist and a scientist. And he wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. He's part of something known as the Intelligent Design Movement, which much of that I really enjoy, but there's also some of it that I don't always accept. So, listener, just be advised. You'll find some good stuff, but don't take it wholeheartedly. Don't take everything about it. Be wise and be discerning. What Michael Behe did is he spent most of his career studying a bacteria. And a bacteria generally is a single-celled organism. Now, the argument of Darwin is I can go from a single cell, randomly time and chance, to a giant, like we have trillions of cells in our bodies. And I can be like a multi-cell organism. Just as an aside, I'm pretty sure there's no such thing as a two-cell organism, three-cell, four-cell, five-cell, six-cell. There's none of them. You've got a single cell, and then it jumps right to complex beings. That in and of itself is kind of challenging. If this really happened that way, we should see two-cell, we should see three, four, five, we should see all the colors of the rainbow. Why would all of those die out except for the single cells? That doesn't make any sense. But that's another issue. In Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box, he studies the bacteria. He tells you a bacteria, and he studies one part of the bacteria. He studies what's called the flagellum. Now, guys, I sent you an illustration. I texted it to you. And the listener doesn't have this picture in front of them, so I need you to tell me, what are you looking at? What does it look like? Okay? So listeners, this is kind of like when you get blindfolded and someone tells you how to draw something and you just have to draw it. You guys are going to have to envision this yourself. Guys, what are you looking at?
You sure you want to do this?
I want to do this, Charlie. Charlie, this is the feature part of the content right here, especially you doing the describing. I think maybe we make Charlie. Yikes.
I don't feel like I should bear this burden alone.
Josh, do you want to give it a shot?
Not particularly. It looks like one of the arms of an octopus.
Okay.
Reaching down into the plumbing.
Okay.
Of a toilet.
It does. It looks like those gaskets that are like a jelly kind of a gasket. Yep. Yep.
I was thinking more mechanical because you have an L ring and then a P ring, I think it is, and then some other ring, like a MS ring. And so in between various layers, two different layers. So it looks almost like a mechanical structure.
Okay. Is there anything in the real world that, like, the listener can't look at this? I think the octopus arm reaching down into a toilet thing, that's pretty good, Josh. Is there anything else that looks like? To me, a little bit looks like a crankshaft.
Yeah, you have the rod.
So you have the rod, and then you have these kind of things around there that look like maybe what they could be, like a crank arm. Okay. And then, what else do you see?
It makes a 90-degree turn, about 90-degree turn, okay. Not quite. There's okay. A filament and then the subunit that's like the shaft thing that goes down and takes a 90-degree turn between two...
What are these things?
Yeah, what are those?
What are those pink or purplish
layers?
Well, it
says outer membrane and inner membrane. Okay, but I just sent you another picture without a bunch of stuff taken off. So
it's a lipid bilayer.
It is. It's a lipid bilayer. So go ahead and look at the second picture I sent you. What I wanted to do is I wanted to give it to you without much context and see if you could figure out what you're looking at. So now I think what you can see is, yeah, it's one of the tails of the bacteria.
And that's why I wanted to be quiet, because I knew what
you've seen this,
flagellum
yeah.
means.
Okay, okay. There you go. Anyway. Well done. Well done. So, Charlie, why don't you describe, now that you can be more open, what are they looking at?
We're looking at, effectively, where a tail would sprout out of a thing.
Yep. And you've got two membranes. That's like the cell
walls. I'm not
sure
what the politically correct term for it would be.
Okay. It looks kind of like an angled joint attached with some sort of a whip-like tail appendage. There is a shaft that goes down through two layers of what looks like a cell wall. And then there's some rings, or it's almost like a bearing structure on a crankshaft. Okay. Yeah. There's like three bearings, and it looks like maybe some sort of a bushing. That holds one of the rings on. And then you have these, it's called motor complexes. They look like ovals, like really stretched out ovals.
The yellow.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Those are part of the electrical system. So this is a electrical magnetic run spinning joint. So what you're looking at is a shaft that goes through the cell wall, has some like bearing type things, and it spins, and it does this by having an electromagnetic pulse put through it so it can spin in a circle. The tail whips around, and then this is how the bacteria is able to move through the viscosity of its where it's at, like the liquid it's in. So essentially, the best illustration, though it doesn't look exactly like this, is an outboard motor. And when you look at the components, it has 40 different parts that make it operate. It's literally liquid cooled. So to keep it from overheating, there's a way that water can get in and out. And it spins at, get this, 100,000 RPM. That's 100,000 spins in 1 minute. Now, I don't know if any of you guys have been race-ish, like race car drivers back in the day. Like race car driver ish.
Well, that took a turn.
Yep. Yep. Well, we've gone down another route here. Have you guys had lead feet ever? Have you ever been like into? Okay.
No.
So some people, and I won't say who, have gotten their car up to very high speeds, and it gets kind of unsafe. When you're going like really fast and you know you shouldn't, do you immediately step on the brakes, or do you kind of like just pull off and let the car slow down?
Depends how heavy my feet are.
Well, let's say you're going 80 on the interstate and you're like, oh, I shouldn't do this. Do you just stomp on the brake as hard as you can?
No.
No, that'd cause a problem. Now, here's the other thing. The tachometer in your car, what does it generally go up to? How many thousand, like how many revolutions per minute, RPM?
Like 6,000 to 8,000.
Yeah, 6,000 to 8,000. Tim, would you ever want your minivan at 8,000 RPM?
You know, my third son just started driving.
It's
and he learned about pressing the gas pedal when it's in park.
Oh, okay. This is good. So
we only went up to about 4K.
Okay.
But I taught him some lessons about revving the engine. And
that's stuff. Okay. So this is perfect. So you get the engine up to 4,000 RPM. You pull your feet off of it. How long does it take it to go back down to like normal?
Yeah, I mean, it goes down pretty quickly.
Pretty quickly, yeah. If it was up at 100,000 RPM, how long do you think it would need to slow down?
It would take a little while.
A little while, yeah. In fact, if you could put a clamp in there, and it's going 100,000 RPM, and then you want it to stop, and you clamped it so hard, it stopped in a quarter turn.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to that engine?
It breaks.
It explodes.
Mm-hmm.
The cool thing about this outboard motor is it can go from 100,000 RPM to zero and the other direction in a quarter of a turn.
Wow.
It is the most amazingly complex and fine-tuned device I've ever seen at this nano level. Now, Behe spends his entire book showing, look how complex this is. However, it's complex in a very specific way, and he calls it irreducible. So what he says is this has 40 different parts. If I were to take out one part, you can pick any part you want, it isn't just that it runs poorly or badly or inefficiently, it literally doesn't work. So what Michael Behe does is he says, if evolution is true and one part has to develop over 100,000 years and another part has to develop over 100,000 years, another part, for that bacteria to propagate, reduplicate, whatever, and then pass on a genetic error to the next one and the next one and the next one, it has to be able to get to a food source. The only way it can move is with this outboard motor. If the outboard motor doesn't function, it can't get to food, it can't reproduce, it dies, we never have the mutations. So it has been very interesting watching the evolutionists try to surmount this argument. And it makes them look like fools. They're like, well, what if it develops? And they come up with all these solutions that go outside of their own rules. They can't follow physics. They can't follow science. And they just make stuff up. So Behe's argument has been very effective. Now, for some of you, I lost you. Sorry, listener. That got kind of intense. So let's do it this way. The illustration Behe uses in his book is a mousetrap. So how many parts are there to a mousetrap? Let's think that through. Well, you've got the base. Okay, that's one. You've got the anchor bracket that goes across the middle to hold everything down. That's two. You've got the spring that holds the tension on the neck breaker bar. That's three. And you have the neck breaker bar. That's four. You have the anchor that holds the trigger and the bar down. That's five. You've got the anchor holding the anchor. That's six. You have the bait trigger. That's seven. And you have the bait. I think you got to count the bait. That's eight. So the mousetrap only has eight parts. Now here's the thing, and I do this in class. What part of that could be missing and the mousetrap still work? And a lot of times they're like, well, the base, you could just mount it to the counter. But what did you do? You just switched to a different base. Like, I can't put all those metal pieces down and it won't work. What about the spring? And so we go through every part and none of it, you can't reduce it anymore. Let's say that mousetrap was a like biological organism. And the way it gets to copy itself is by killing a mouse, okay? It kills a mouse, immediately duplicates. And let's say at some point it develops a mutation and suddenly there's a spoiler on the back, like just like a car, like a spoiler. Okay, it looks fancy. And maybe you add to it, but you can never get back below this point of irreducible complexity. And so it really blows a hole in the theory of evolution because the argument is you need time and chance. But if I can't get to this irreducible complex item, then I really show that evolution actually functionally cannot work. So this is really interesting. So listener, what you could do, and we're not done, but what you could do is you could get online and you could look up Irreducible Complexity, Michael Behe. And the Discovery Institute is an intelligent design movement organization page. And there's a video by Stephen Meyer on it and some others. And they explain how this works. And it's quite a powerful argument. It really is. So anyways, what do you guys think about that argument? You got any comments? You got any thoughts? Any ideas? The idea here is that, hey, I meet an unbeliever who doesn't think God is real and God exists. And you ask, why is that? And they say, well, evolution has been proven true. What do you think about deploying this argument? What do you think? Send them the video.
I mean, I think there's just value in that. It's like, well, you know, I think of Greg Kokol and just tactics and then just putting a stone in their shoe and help them to think through their worldview a little bit more in light of this information to create some doubt. And then just hopefully help them to be a little bit more receptive to a different option. I could see the value of that type maybe there.
Okay. Okay. Any other comments or thoughts? Well, is there any question of the effectiveness of this kind of an argument? Maybe I'm anticipated a rebuttal wrongly. I thought there might be one.
I think there's value to it.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not sure what you're thinking. Do you think somebody would be persuaded by it? Like to believe in God? I don't think they're going to be persuaded by it.
Okay.
If that's what you're thinking.
So every year I have a student or more who will say, but then they'll just come up with a different argument or they'll just find something different. I'm like, yeah. And so there's like a dual element here to this talking about this argument. I really like these. I think these are helpful. I was talking to a student one time and they were having doubts about God's existence. And we had talked about this before. And so I sent them a video that demonstrated a different kind of an argument. And as we talked it through, they couldn't really surmount the argument, but it didn't really take away the doubt either. As we kept talking, it became less about apologetics and more about discipling the believer. And I would say we probably need to now go to Romans chapter 1. And Romans 1 will kind of give us a principle of why or how to use this. So I do think there's some well-meaning apologists out there, and I don't begrudge them. I'm very thankful for their work. I'm thankful for their effort in finding ways that the unbeliever's accounting of reality doesn't fit. But sometimes it almost is like they promise more than it can deliver. And so much of apologetics has this idea that if we can just give the unbeliever knowledge, then they'll believe. Now, reverse that real quick. If I say that unbeliever just needs knowledge and then they would believe, what's the contrary also true statement that I could make? Can you reverse that logically?
I'm not sure where you're going. Are you thinking like if I give knowledge, then they could be persuaded not to believe? Is that the reverse
that you're going to? That's really good. That was a good guess. Nope.
Okay, give me the front end again.
If we just give the unbeliever knowledge they don't have, then they will be able to believe. What's the reverse? I could make a reverse statement that would be equally as true.
Well, if you give different knowledge.
Okay. Okay, that's a counter. Good.
Okay,
good.
Maybe so that's not where you're going. Nope. Okay.
So I'll just spell it out. If I think, man, if that unbeliever just knew this, then they would believe. I'm also saying the reason that unbeliever doesn't believe is because they lack knowledge.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So mm-hmm. What have I made the reason for their unbelief?
Knowledge.
Knowledge. Mm-hmm. Is that what Scripture says?
Mm-mm. No, it's not.
It absolutely says the opposite. The reason a person doesn't believe, even one who's never heard of the name of Christ or Christianity, the reason they don't believe is because they rebel against what they already know. And so let's go to Romans chapter 1, and we're not going to go through the whole thing. In it, Paul is going to show that all humans stand condemned before God. And that's a big statement to make, especially when you like, who would Paul have been thinking? The Greeks, the Scythians, like all these foreigners who have never heard of the Old Testament Torah and the Old Testament history books, let alone Jesus and his own and Paul's writings. And he's saying all of those people are condemned. So in verse 18, he says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Now I want to stop. That word suppress there means to hold something down. And my favorite illustration is, you know, when you go to the pool and you have like a beach ball and you and your buddies try to hold the beach ball under the water. When you let go, what does the ball do? Shoots right back up. So you have to continue to actively hold that ball down. That is the best picture of suppression. Unbelievers know something. It's inconvenient for them. And so they try to cover it up and hold it down. What is it that they know? It goes on to say, verse 19, for what can be known about God is plain to them. So whatever this thing is that they're suppressing, it's plain to them. And then it says, because God has shown it to them. So hold on. There is something that God has shown every unbeliever on the face of the planet throughout all time that they know plainly, don't want to know, and they suppress. And what do they do to suppress it? They use their unrighteousness. That's how they suppress it. So what is this thing? Verse 20, he says, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. Now, what it's saying is that every human who's ever looked at a tree or looked up at the stars or wondered how their hand works, anyone who's ever noticed general revelation and the order and design in it knows the nature of God. They know there's someone that's eternally powerful and not just a force, but a person. And that the nature of that person is not just like a Greek god or a Roman god that's just a like a superpower human. It is the God. It is the maker. So all humans know this, but don't like it and suppress it in their sin. So when and it says, how do they know that? It says, in the things that have been made. So God has literally designed the universe so that when we look at it and study it, when we marvel at its complexity and fine-tuning, when we see things that are irreducibly complex, when we look at a mountain that's beautiful or a sunset that's picturesque, a view of a scenery that takes our breath away, when we see those things, we know God exists. And this existing of God is not something that we don't have an interest in, because we're sinners and we know we stand condemned before that God. Now, the passage will go on and talk about that condemnation. We won't take time to walk through it. Why I want to bring this up, though, is when I show someone this picture of a outboard motor on a single cell organism, this flagella tail, or any other thing, the woodpecker tongue is amazing. If you've never looked up the woodpecker's tongue, it's shocking. His eyeballs, actually, every time the woodpecker hits a tree, the force is so great, it would throw the eyeballs out onto the tree. It would bust them. So the woodpecker triangulates, looks, and then blinks his eye shut, hits the tree, comes back, looks, and it's like this. Imagine every time a jackhammer hit, your eye blinked, but it just did that automatically. That's how the woodpecker's, how do you do that? The tongue goes all the way around back his head, out. It has like a, it's just amazing. So you can look up anything in the biological world, and you can see clearly, this looks more like the design of my iPhone than just some rock that happened to spit out of a volcano in the shape that it is. Why then don't people look at these arguments and believe? Because they don't need education. They need humility. They need to bow the knee before their maker. Now, it doesn't mean I don't use these arguments, but the way I would always use them is not to persuade for belief. It would be to demonstrate the reason you give me for not believing God exists doesn't hold water, and you yourself would know it. Now, listener, what do we do with this if we're a believer? Well, I found great encouragement in looking at these arguments. If doubts creep in or questions come out, there's so many resources today from Christians who answer these kinds of questions. However, The Bible doesn't say that my doubts come from not knowing information. Doubts come from attacks from the enemy, but oftentimes they come because I'm not walking in humility before the Lord. Sometimes I'm a rebel, and my rebellion leads to not receiving the assurance of my sonship before the Lord. So, listener, this week, if you'd like to be encouraged, look up the flagellum tale. Look up irreducible complexity. It's a really neat little argument, and it's really bolstering to your faith. But if you're working out, if you're dealing with doubts, reach out to your pastor. Reach out to somebody. And remember, doubts grow out of a heart of unbelief, and unbelief is related more to suppression than ignorance. Okay? So dive into the Word. Reach out to another believer. Don't walk the Christian life alone. And look out at nature at least once a day and just praise God for His amazingness.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind.